Hi, this is Jason.
And this is Corey.
We're from loosechange911.com. We'll find out the truth about 9/11 there right now, and...
You're listening to Ghostly Talk.
Questing for the mystery of life can get old. It's like looking for a break in a code. Deduce it, reduce it, dissolve it. Just try to resolve it. The best you can get is a mercurial hold. It's like plucking all the petals off a rose to find the mystery of all the beauty it holds. One by one they are falling. Still no secret is called.
The one big question. How do you get crucifixion, resurrection, and then chocolate bunnies colored eggs? How do you do that one? Even kids are going,
rabbits don't lay eggs. What is this?
And you don't want a kid biting the head off a chocolate Jesus. That's not good. You don't want a little cream-filled cross going, no, you don't want that. And you don't want to be putting raspberry jam in the grass going, we're looking for Jesus, kids. Come on.
Thank you. really fun. I'm still trying to get my. It's I'm quiet over here. I know I am.
I'm happy I showed up for work today.
Yeah. Yes. I've been sitting here going.
I wasn't not going to come, but I did extend my my weekend festivities from we had left out of here on Thursday.
Yeah.
After work on Thursday, and then Friday, and then I extended into Saturday. I extended my weekend festivities up north,
mm-hmm.
and that's why you couldn't get hold of me, Scott, by the way.
Oh yeah.
And then, but I wasn't going to miss Ghostly Talk. I couldn't. It was just didn't even enter my mind. But boy, am I glad I showed up. I'm glad I never was going to miss the show.
We're talking with Stephen E. Rowdy right now about all. I mean, I can't even classify this. I don't even know how to get these names. I mean, there's just so much stuff we covered like in a half an hour. I don't even know where we're going to start from here. You do have a couple of books that. Well, you have one book out right now. Am I correct, Stephen?
I have four books out right now.
You have four books out.
But the one that deals with, because for some reason, I don't know why, but the we started talking about psychokinesis and these big, you know, experiments and things like that into like the old physical phenomena that physical mediumship produces. And The Limits of Influence is your book that deals with that topic, right? And then you have the Life After Death. Book.
That book is called Immortal Remains.
Remains. You know what, everybody? Our website, www.ghostlytalk.com, we have a link up to Stephen's webpage,
yeah.
And it'll be up there permanently.
Yeah. It's always in our links section. Anybody that comes on the show, you go to our links page, and usually if you go down towards the bottom, it's where we add them. You know, per list, you know, per I'm sorry, per guest, you have there's a link to his page there.
I highly recommend checking it out and keeping up to date on what Stephen's doing and doing next. Because this is incredible. Thank you, Stephen, for joining us again.
Oh, thank you.
Now, we talked about this a little. We touched on it last half hour a little bit, and I'm still trying to get my arms around it. I'm still kind of floating around here, like I said. We mentioned this the destructive nature of man, which is something that I'm very interested in, obviously. I every day I walk around wondering why people are so idiotic and stupid. They do the most irrational things, it seems, you know, in my little mind, I guess, to get things done. And we kind of got talking about that a little bit, and we kind of got into this idea of whether it was like a conscious or an unconscious thing to do that. And there's all types of different things that are done. We mentioned when we were on break for a second that, like I mentioned before, you know, codependent type people. You know, is this a conscious thing they're doing or an unconscious thing? I happen to think, you know, from what I've seen of people I've known and whatnot, I think it's an unconscious type thing because, you know, for example, I'll go to this person and go, listen, here's what you need to do. You're on your own now, right? Do your thing. Do this, be that person. But make yourself happy, right? That's kind of like the idea I try to instill on them. And I'll tell it to them, tell it to this person or whoever till I'm blue in the face. That, you know, make yourself happy. You need to be happy with yourself. And then 2 weeks later, they'll have somebody else moved into their house. you follow what I'm saying? So it seems
I mean, just think of all the ways in which people don't use the information they in particular should have at their disposal. I mean, think of all the doctors who get hooked on drugs or smoke cigarettes or the lawyers who get into legal trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Or the psychologists who make a shambles of their own life, even if they're good at helping guide their clients.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's examples of that everywhere, obviously, too. And these are the people that they're supposed to be authorities in that field. I mean, you just named like four different professions, for example. That, you know, obviously, you see a doctor smoking, that makes you go, okay, what's going on here? This don't make a whole lot of sense. Why is a doctor smoking? And like you said, that's because these people they're not utilizing the information they have in front of them. It seems like, am I correct?
Yes. I mean, so you have to wonder. When you talk about the destructiveness of human nature, it doesn't always have to be other directed. It could be self directed.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Well, that is self-directed. I mean, this codependency issue, which I'll mention again,
right.
that is self-directed. I mean,
it's self-destructive behavior. Yeah,
it's self-destructive behavior. Now that's an unconscious thing, or is that a conscious thing more or less? I mean, it seems to me like it may be more of an unconscious idea then.
Well, it's in our interest for it to be unconscious, because if it was conscious, then we'd very easily have to blame ourselves.
Yeah, you'd have to take responsibility for that directly.
Right.
I see what you're. Now I'm starting to understand what's going on here. And now, as far as now, what we were talking about in the last half hour too, about this idea of psychokinetic powers, where if we had free reign of this, we, like you said, Stephen, we'd have to take responsibility for that. As far as our powers, we would have to take responsibility for that too. See,
now let me tell you something about that. I mean,
okay.
After this. Well, let me back up. At the beginning of the 20th century, more and more researchers started taking seriously the idea that these great physical mediums were actually producing a phenomena and not simply mediating between the physical world and the spiritual world, okay?
Okay.
And even though the great mediums didn't believe this themselves, this was an idea that was more and more in the air, so to speak, and it was harder for the mediums to ignore it. And it was at about this time that the phenomena that they produced started getting smaller and smaller in magnitude. And so by the time you get to the mid-20th century, the so-called PK superstars of the time, people like Felicia Paris and Nina Kulagina, these are people who completely believed that they were producing a phenomena themselves. And if you watch the films of them, you see them sweating and straining to produce the smallest object movements. Now, I mean, think about this from their point of view. If they have to work that hard to make a small object move a small distance, then they don't have to worry about making tables levitate or making cars crash or anything of the kind. From their point of view, they'd have to suffer internal hemorrhaging before that ever happened.
Okay.
So, I mean, to me, that just strengthens my conviction that the reason we saw such dramatic phenomena during the heyday of spiritualism was that the people who produced the phenomena literally didn't think they were in any way responsible, and they deeply believed it.
And through that type of thinking, that may have opened the floodgate, so to say.
Exactly right.
To let these types of things happen. So it's kind of like the same scenario where if you're trying too hard, you usually mess it up. If you're more late, that's what I find myself doing with a lot of activities. If I'm thinking about it too much, or if I'm trying too hard to do it perfect every time, that I usually mess it up worse.
That's me in bowling.
Yeah.
Me in bowling. If I concentrate on it, I got a ball. If I'm like, ooh, I just did a really good frame, you know, watch me follow it up with a gutter ball, because I want this thing so bad, you know, and I mess it up myself. So when the spiritual, and for the record, I mean, this is written down, you can look it up, read Parapsychologie, mediums in the mediumship movement, or in the spiritualist movement, were running around the world, because they were invited all over the world. Mm. And they would go to these, you know, meetings of scientists, people trying to figure out what this was and how this was working, and they would do these experiments under as controlled conditions as possible, and things happened. I mean, you read these books, and just, like, amazing things happen. I mean, flower pots.
You want a great example?
Yeah.
One of my favorite examples is from the late 19th century. The medium was D.D. Hume, H-O-M-E.
Mm-hmm.
This is a guy who...
He would walk out windows or something.
There's one alleged case where he allegedly levitated out one window and came in another, but it was in darkness, and it's not well documented.
Oh, okay.
Much better and important cases. But this is a guy who practiced mediumship for almost a quarter of a century. He was never caught cheating. He would conduct seances on the spur of the moment in places he'd never been before, so there's no question of him having concealed a Confederate or planted an apparatus or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
He was investigated by the famous physicist William Crookes. And one of Hume's favorite phenomena was making an accordion play either untouched or held away at the end away from the keys. Now, Hume thought that the phenomena were strongest under the seance table, which sounds a little suspicious. But Crookes figured, well, if that's what Hume believes, let's try to work around that. And here's what he did. And I think this is one of the most important experiments in the history of parapsychology. First of all, Crookes bought a new accordion. So there could be no question that this was one of Hume's props. Right?
Yeah.
He then went to Hume's apartment to pick him up. He watched Hume change clothes. So he could determine that there was no device concealed on his person that would make this happen, although this was 1871. It's not clear what kind of device this would have been.
Mm-hmm.
Then he took Hume to his house, And he had constructed a wire and wooden cage, which fit under his dining room table, and the accordion was placed in the cage. There was just enough room for Hume to get his hand under the tabletop and into the cage to hold the accordion at the end away from the keys.
Yeah.
Not enough room to reach his hand into the cage to actually manipulate the keys and the accordion.
Yeah.
There were nine observers present, most of them stationed on either side of Hume and one under the table. Under those conditions, the accordion moved in and out. The keys were depressed. Sounds came out of the accordion. Then Hume took his hand out of the cage, put both of his hands on the table. The accordion still flopped around inside the cage.
Oh,
everybody saw this.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh,
now, no skeptic has ever even tried to replicate that, and I think for good reason. They haven't a clue how to do it.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Under those conditions.
That's a pretty phenomenal thing. I mean, it's a very controlled situation, too.
Exactly.
And not controlled by D.D. Hume.
Right, exactly.
This was controlled by William Crookes.
Yeah. That's fascinating. God, that's so fascinating to hear about that. I mean, as far as...
But they were doing you know, similar experiments, I mean, where they would try to control the situation as best as possible, and still the medium would somehow make physical phenomena happen, or physical phenomena would happen. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know if it was the medium, but you know, hey, it happened in their presence, and
right.
And they would produce these effects, and for some reason in the old literature, I can't read French, so I didn't read what is it, Trait de Parapsychologie. I didn't read the French version, but I read the English translation, and they were talking about these experiments as if. Oh, yeah, this happened and that happened and the other thing happened. And I'm thinking, wow, this was like 40 or 50 years ago. Oh, this is probably 60 years ago now. And they were writing this report that became the, you know, the Treaty of Parapsychology, Treaties on Parapsychology, I'm sorry. They were writing about it as if it were everyday occurrences, right?
Mm. Well, it was pretty frequent around that period. I mean, there was a lot more of it happening then than there is now.
Right, and now we've got... You know, more mental mediumship, obviously.
Well, I mean, the study of psychokinesis has turned, for better or for worse, to laboratory studies, usually dealing with trying to affect random generators.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the spiritualist movement itself, I mean, obviously things are a lot more different nowadays. We talked about that a little bit, and I'm still trying to, because nowadays... Obviously, as of right now, it's a big thing. There's a lot of shows on the subject now, as far as the paranormal, ghosts, things like
right.
that. There's a lot. So now it seems like it's taking an upturn, you know, for the future. We'll have to see what happens. But there has been this lull point, though. We always talk about like the good old days. Me and Doug are like, you know, there's all these documented cases from the good old days, and that's during the spiritualist movement, obviously. But you know, now it don't seem like there's that only, like, how do you say it, Doug? It's like this old school type medium seance type thing going on. I mean, there was this mindset. It seemed like there was this major mindset change, though, right around the 50s. Well, between the 50s and 60s, there was stuff obviously still going on. You were part of something, Stephen. You were part of a seance of that sort. I'm wondering what happened to our minds, though. I've asked this question to a lot of people. What happened to us after the 50s, though, after this big movement? And obviously we've talked about one thing.
I wonder if it's something as simple as Hollywood or something. I mean, here's the thing. Okay,
okay.
I myself witnessed what I think is an absolutely amazing event.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely amazing. Stephen, we're ghost hunters by choice, and that's our hobby, and well, so is broadcasting, but, you know,
yeah.
We're ghost hunters is a hobby, and we go out and about looking for neat stuff and documenting this stuff, whether it's real or not, whether it's proof of an actual ghost or proof that weird things happen, we're collecting the proof.
And yeah,
we're collecting the proof, which unfortunately will always be held skeptical, because
yeah.
You can always doctor a tape, you can always doctor a photograph, things
yeah.
like that. And unfortunately some people do and ruin it for the rest of us. But we still go out and about. We still look for this stuff. And I witnessed several things at the Holly Hotel, but the most amazing thing that I've ever seen are still the fingerprints on the bridge.
Yeah.
Okay, and it makes no sense. And, yeah, there might be a mundane explanation if I had, you know, Einstein and several physicists and, you know, that kind of stuff. I don't have those available to me, so I can't explain it. And it's still pretty darn weird. Mm-hmm. And I really revel in that memory. That memory helps keep me going. That memory really fascinates me, things like that. But it's nothing that, like, you would do an hour special on in Hollywood, because there were no killings.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't kill anyone, and so there were no killings. And
As far as I know.
And there were no, you know, there was no dramatic thing with special effects, and Bruce Lee wasn't there, and, you know, so it wasn't Hollywood material. It was just a bunch of fingerprints on a bridge that shouldn't have probably been there.
Yeah.
And they just appeared?
Right, just that one day. Just that one day, and they weren't there the exact 1 year to the day or 1 year to the calendar day later, because I checked both days.
Mm-hmm.
They were only there that one day, and it was these fingerprints as if people were, like, a dozen or more people were climbing up out of the water onto the bridge. That's how the fingerprints were positioned. We couldn't recreate them. We have living human hands ourselves, right? We're equipped with them, and we take them wherever we go, and we were there, and they were there, and we pushed them onto the bridge as hard as we could. And we could make, you know, like, I don't know, our oil impression or whatever.
Yeah, but that goes away after a couple of minutes.
After a second. These things were there for a good, 45 minutes before we finally thought, well, these aren't going away, we're leaving.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we would wipe them away, they'd come right back. These were just bizarre. And,
it doesn't, obviously, something like that, it is phenomenal in its own right, but it doesn't make a great story, which may tie into why there was this huge downswing.
Right. It doesn't make a great story, like the accordion, like walking out one window and in another, like, apporting.
Table tipping itself. Yeah.
Flower vases apporting, from.
It still happens, but in sort of isolated instances, there still are spiritual enclaves in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Casadega in New York, in mm-hmm. Florida, Lilydale in New York, for example.
Yeah, and I know there's always been groups working on this sort of thing, but it just seems like, as far as documented evidence goes, and, you know, I mean, how far can we go with that, too? It seems like as if there was just a cutoff point with a lot of the documented evidence where people were actually shooting photos of these sessions, documenting stories of these sessions. It seemed like there was just a huge downswing on that. But
it's
now
got a lot of bad press, and these days a lot of scientists who are trained in laboratory studies, they just don't want to dirty their hands doing it. I mean, and a lot of them don't have job security. You know, I have tenure, so, I can do whatever the hell I want.
Well, that is a big problem. I know that's why a lot of people have had problems with that, people who want to take on this sort of stuff and try to work on it. You're totally right. There isn't that much job security nowadays. That's a big factor as far as you're a scientist or a doctor of some sort's reputation is concerned. They could lose their job working on something like this. I mean, I that is a huge thing also.
So, and even though I have tenure, I've taken a lot of heat for this, as you can probably imagine.
Undoubtedly. Yeah. I mean, the set that you hang around with, the high academia set, right? Mm-hmm. Very political.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, kudos to you for surviving. Because that's a tough crowd. Mental mediumship is perhaps related to a natural phenomena of PK, right? That's a stretch already, although one that, you know, it's not something that I've been, like, you know, not thought of.
Yeah, exactly.
But what about ghosts? I mean, could there be ghosts then?
Well, there's interesting haunting phenomena. There's no doubt about that. As compelling evidence of life after death, I don't think it's the strongest we have, because, you know, if human beings can do things like lifting tables or making objects move or what have you, then a lot of the phenomena of haunting could equally be the psychokinetic products of the living. And usually haunting cases aren't evidential. That is, they don't connect in clear ways to anything past. They don't give us any information that wasn't already known to the living. So Well, I think there's very interesting and compelling evidence suggesting life after death. We're not going to get it from haunting cases.
And a lot of it, like you said, also, again, and we've been hearing this a lot from people, is a lot of it is could very well be a manifestation of the living itself.
Right.
And that's the real interesting point right there. I mean, it seems like it's being shifted to that direction.
This is the second week in a row
we've
talked about this.
Third week in a row. Yeah.
Third week in a row that we've talked about this.
That's why I'm always amused when I see people who call themselves ghost hunters or ghostbusters, and they go into homes with all the fancy equipment as if they're going to learn something about the site. But, I mean, it's crazy, it seems to me. We know that people can affect machines. So it's not as if these people go in with these machines and they've got PK barriers around themselves, so they can't personally affect them.
Yeah,
to me, it looks completely naive.
And that's what we've been hearing from other people, too. It's the same thing. It's like...
I haven't heard that particularly before, but I mean, I do believe that. And it could happen, assuming the PK ability. Why does everybody have PK?
Well, we don't know that they do, but I'd say potentially... I see no reason to think that potentially we don't all have it. Maybe not all consciously. And it may, again, be in our interest not to be able to do it consciously. But, you know, we all like to think that we could potentially be able to do things like heal people or make our prayers somehow work out in reality. But this is just the flip side of that coin. You know, I don't know anything that can be used exclusively for the good. So if we think that our wishes can have positive influence, I think that's just one aspect of wishing that we had some kind of positive PK, but it can't just be positive.
I think still, I think it may be the same application as far as hauntings or people that go out to try to find these things, ghost hunters. It may be the same application as the mediumship spectrum, the spiritualist movement. Don't try so hard. That's what I'm still thinking.
So.
Don't try so hard. Walk in there. I mean, and I think it may also be, you know, and we've talked to other people that have said as far as to try to, you know, yield results, to try to get EVPs or whatnot, that...
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, you have to have that intention there, too. You just can't walk in there and think you're just going to turn a recorder on and people are going to voluntarily talk. You have to have that intention there. But the problem with that, though, if you try to take those two ideas together, you have this intention, which is you're trying hard, right? You're trying. You're thinking this thing through. You want this to happen. And then you have this other idea we were talking about with you where it says, look, okay, let's just try to, you know, we're not trying so hard here. Let's just let the things happen. Let's let the gates open up as they will and let things happen as they will. Those are two fascinating ideas, but they kind of, in my opinion, they kind of bump heads a little bit, too. You know what I'm saying?
Didn't we talk to some, we have so few minutes left.
Yeah.
this new scheduling. This is the first time I've not liked it. we did talk to the one lady, and I can't remember her name offhand. She's running the experiment. An EVP type experiment, but not to get EVPs from ghosts or anything.
Oh.
It's to get EVPs from yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And she had described, for example, holding up the tape recorder and thinking what you want to hear on that tape and then see if it comes out. And she said, send your successful and your unsuccessful experiments to her. Do you remember?
I'm totally blanking out right now.
Because it was about 4 or 5 months ago. I'm going to have to grab that. Because if anybody knows what I'm talking about,
please hit us up again about that.
Let us know, because I'd like to announce it during the show. But if not, go back in the archives, and it was a lady came on and described this experiment
mm-hmm.
that she was doing. I want more of that. I want more experimentation into this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
That's
absolutely
a great way to start,
mm-hmm.
is start experimenting. Can you affect the machine? And start thinking, you know.
Try some table tilting.
Tilting. try this EVP experiment, which will be, you know.
We'll announce
judged.
It again. We'll announce it again.
We got to get her back on.
We have to have her come back on.
I want to. I want to know how it's going.
Hit us
if
with an
people
email.
Have done it, and talking with Stephen here says that, you know. What if it very well could be possible.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know more about this.
Absolutely. Steve, we need to thank you for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
It's been an absolute
exciting
hour. Thank
look
you.
Up The Limits of Influence,
mm-hmm.
and look up also Immortal Remains
mm-hmm.
by Stephen E. Browdy,
mm-hmm.
B-R-A-U-D-E. Also, go to our website, www.ghostlytalk.com, and permanently in the links section
check out Stephen's
will be
page,
a link to his webpage, and I'm sure that you keep that updated with your current projects and things
you're doing
and places you're going. Yeah. Excellent. Thank you, Stephen. This has been a fascinating hour.
Yeah. We got more coming,
so
too.
I am so thankful to you.
We still have
a lot
more to do. Thank you, Stephen.
Bye-bye.
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 See you later. Yeah, we have so much more coming up. Why don't we take a quick break, though? We're going to be getting on the line Mr. Michael Cremo, where we're going to be talking about forbidden archaeology.
Hey, I'm Yuri Geller, and right now I am transmitting a thought into your mind. Can you feel it? Yes, it is my website, www.urigeller.com. And guess what? I love Ghostly Talk. These guys, Scott, Doug, and Will, are supernaturally great.
Michael Cremo is on the cutting edge of science and cultural issues. In the course of a few months' time, he might be found on a pilgrimage to sacred sites in India, appearing on a national television show, lecturing at a mainstream science conference, or speaking to an alternative science gathering. As he crosses disciplinary and cultural boundaries, he presents to his various audiences a compelling case for negotiating a new consciousness of the nature of reality.
A new consensus. On the nature of reality. You did so well.
I had a huge lunch. I don't have
you don't have to read the press release. You can throw in your own words.
There you go. All right. I'm doing my own thing here, all right? Let me do my own thing.
That wasn't so bad. Usually we flatter them totally.
It's been a bad day. I've been just kind of like, I had that huge lunch for Easter, you know, and I'm like, right now. Michael, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming on.
Well, great to be with you, Scott, Doug, all your listeners.
Thank you. Now, the main thing we're going to talk about here, and this is what really caught my eye, was this idea of forbidden archaeology. And I'm sure there are tons of things to talk about under this. But what, I mean, as far as the belly of this, to get us started, the term forbidden archaeology, what are we talking about there, more or less?
We're talking about archaeological evidence that contradicts the current theories of human origins. Most scientists today now believe that humans like you and me and your listeners came into existence about 100,000 years ago, having evolved from more primitive ape-like ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, when I did 8 years of research into the whole history of archaeology, I found something different. I found that over the past 150 years, archaeologists from all over the world have discovered huge amounts of evidence in the form of human skeletons, human artifacts, and human footprints going back tens of millions, even hundreds of millions of years. And this evidence contradicts, you know, the currently dominant theories of human origins. This evidence isn't very well known. That's why I call it forbidden archaeology. Yeah, because say if we were to look at archaeology as a big museum, what we would find is that, you know, the public, the general public, is allowed into only one tiny room of that museum, and there they find, you know, just the discoveries that go along with the current theories. But there are other doors in that big museum of archaeology, doors with locks on them, and what I've tried to do is take the locks off the doors, let people in to see what's inside. And what we find is huge amounts of evidence that just totally contradicts, you know, the current theories of recent human origins.
There's no, like, Freedom of Information Act for archaeology studies.
No, artifacts themselves.
How do you just say, oh, I'm interested in this, can I see that?
Well, it's actually quite interesting, because it's not as straightforward as, you know, many people might think. Because, I mean, let me give an example.
Okay.
A couple of years ago, I was involved in the production of an NBC television special called The Mysterious Origins of Man. The producer was a man named Bill Cote out of New York. And he had gotten a hold of my book, and he was interested in incorporating some of the cases mentioned in the book in this NBC documentary. So one of the cases was the California gold mine discoveries. You know, back in the gold mining days, miners went to California to get the gold. And to get the gold, they were digging tunnels into the sides of mountains, like Table Mountain and the Sierra Nevada Mountains.
Mm-hmm. And deep inside these tunnels in the solid rock, the miners were finding human skeletons and human artifacts and layers of rock that, according to modern geological opinion, are about 50 million years old.
Mm-hmm.
So these discoveries were reported to the scientific world by Dr. J.D. Whitney, who was the chief government geologist of California. Mount Whitney is named after him. His report was published by Harvard University. Yeah, but we just don't hear a lot about these discoveries today because of what I call a process of knowledge filtering that operates in the world of science. But, however, I knew that some of the artifacts that he collected from the California gold mines were still in the collection of the Museum of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
So I told the producer, Bill Cote, he should go to that museum and film those artifacts. But when he went there, the museum officials gave all kinds of excuses. You know, they said, oh, you know, you're making a television program. You probably have a very tight deadline. We just wouldn't have time to have our staff go search through our collection to find these things for you. And he said, no, I've got 6 months. You have to do the program. And then they said, well, you know, we would have to pay our staff overtime to do this work. It's not part of their normal duties. We have a very small budget. So he said, no, I'll pay all the expenses. And finally they just said no.
Now,
a couple of years ago I went back because I was doing some research about these discoveries, some further research, because I was going to present a report on these discoveries at a meeting of the World Archaeological Congress, which is the world's largest international organization of archaeologists. So what I did was I proposed a paper to give at this conference, and the organizers of the conference accepted the proposal. So after they accepted the proposal, then I went back to the museum officials and I said, okay, yeah, I've got a paper accepted at the World Archaeological Congress for which I need to do research. And I think because of that, you know, because of that connection with the World Archaeological Congress, they decided, well, maybe it wouldn't be a good idea, you know, to deny me permission. So they did give me permission to study and photograph the artifacts. But it was a whole elaborate thing. You know, it took about 3 months to arrange, because first you have to go there, you have to meet with them, you have to go through their catalog of what they have in the museum, and you have to specify exactly what you want to see, and then they have to review your research proposal, and then you go back to them and they schedule an appointment, you know, and then you have to. But what I found interesting about these particular discoveries is they're not even kept in the museum itself. They're kept in a storage building about, you know, a couple miles, you know, from the museum, and I had to be accompanied by a museum official every step of the way, and it was you know, very interesting. It was sort of like the last scene from the Raiders of the Lost Ark. I don't know if you recall, you know, that
I just
that
watched
film,
that film.
That film where kind of the last scene is they go into the hidden storeroom.
Yeah, that's a huge warehouse. Yeah.
And so it was something like that, really. But I did get to eventually, you know, study and photograph them. So that's the sort of thing. Now, an ordinary person is never going to see these things. An ordinary person is never even going to suspect they're there.
Mm, exactly.
It takes somebody, you know, like me, you know, somebody with, I don't know, this strange predilection to kind of dig beneath the surface a little bit to even suspect that such things are there.
Well, it sounds like, you know, there was a lot of work put into this, obviously, just to be able to get yourself into the same room as these artifacts. It seems like, you know, and it's a common term, I know. It sounds like they just keep throwing the red tape in front of you every time to try to keep you from, you know, try to keep you from getting there. Obviously, you worked past that. Congratulations on that, by the way. That's not a lot of people would have the fortitude to push that far to get themselves
that
close.
Well, yes, I think, or even be, because the knowledge filtering process is just so thorough. Say that if you look in any current textbook of archaeology, you would never even suspect suspect that anyone had ever discovered anything that contradicted the current theories of human origins. You'll see all the discoveries laid out. They appear to go along with the theories that are being proposed. Mm-hmm. And you think that's it. Now, I speak at a lot of universities around the world. Mm-hmm. Graduate students of archaeology, and they are genuinely amazed that there is such a huge body of evidence that they have never even heard of before, not even to hear about it negatively, you know.
Oh, yeah.
not even to hear the professor say, well, somebody found something back in the California gold mines and we know it's nonsense. They don't even mention it at all.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how thorough this knowledge filtering process is. So much so that even the professionals in these fields aren't aware of this evidence, and so it's really kind of interesting. I've gotten into many museums around the world to see these things that people wouldn't suspect were there. Like, for example, well, when I was reading the original reports by Dr. Whitney about the California gold mine discoveries, he mentioned in a little footnote in his report that was published by Harvard University some discoveries that were made by a Portuguese geologist in Portugal who had found human artifacts in formations that belonged to the geological period called the Miocene, the early Miocene. That means they'd be about 20 million years old.
Oh, God.
So I decided, okay, well, let me follow up on this. So I got this geologist's report. His name was Carlos Ribeiro. So I got his reports in the original Portuguese language, you know, from this 19th century scientific publication, and I began going through them. I mean, fortunately, I have a reading knowledge of most of European languages. I lived in Europe when I was younger. So I have a reading knowledge of most of the European languages.
Oh, okay.
And you know, I went through his reports, which were very detailed, and I wrote about them in Forbidden Archaeology. But then a little bit later, you know, I learned there was going to be a meeting of the European Association of Archaeologists in Lisbon, Portugal, in the year 2000. So I decided, okay, that would be a great opportunity to present to these archaeologists a paper about Ribeiro's discoveries that are 20 million years old. So about 6 months before the conference, I went to Lisbon. I had already, see, this is the method that I'm sometimes able to use in order to get into these museums.
Okay.
You know, I proposed a paper to this conference of professional archaeologists. They were interested enough to accept it. So then I could go to the head of the museum and say, okay, there's this big archaeology conference that's being held in your country, in your city, Lisbon. They want to hear from me about these discoveries that were made in your country by one of your scientists. So after a little bit of negotiation, well, he allowed me to see these artifacts. And again, they're not displayed, you know, to the public. They're kept locked in some cabinets down there. Although originally, when Ribeiro first discovered them, he displayed them in this Museum of Geology in Lisbon in the display cases with labels indicating an age of 20 million years. But then later on, after he died, you know, his colleagues said, well, you know, we can't have this. So they put it all away, you know, and after that time, nobody would really suspect that they were there because these things just aren't mentioned in the textbooks anymore. So I did get permission to open up, take the locks off those cabinets. I was able to study and photograph, you know, those artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
So you're kind of asking, you know, how I'm able to do this, and that's one way, you know, that I'm able to do it.
Well, it sounds like a lot of strategic politics. I mean, a lot of this is having to deal with politics, unfortunately, to get yourself access to these certain things, as is a lot of things, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Actually, there's quite a bit of that. There was one famous archaeologist, he once said, archaeology is not a science, it's a vendetta. you know, because, I mean, there is. Even among, I mean, just ordinary professional archaeologists, if an archaeologist discovers something, he very mostly they very jealously guard access to it because, you know, they don't want other scientists or even other archaeologists, you know, messing around with their stuff, particularly if they think they're going to use it in such a way, you know, to contradict what they're going to say about it. So there is a bit of politics and diplomacy about it, and I mean, just even in ordinary professional dealings. And then when you get to larger issues of whether evidence supports or contradicts, you know, the current theories of human origins, then you've entered into a whole new domain where it becomes even
That sounds like you're dealing with a huge ball of wax there. And I've heard the same thing from a lot of people as far as archaeologists went, that there is this, you know, and I find this even, you know, I mean, by trade here on Ghostly Talk, we're paranormal investigators, we're ghost hunters, but we, you know, especially myself, I have a huge, love and appreciation for archaeology and things like this.
In my latest book, I've kind of gotten into some paranormal topics myself.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the common features between, you know, the forbidden archaeology work and the paranormal work is that they both tend to contradict the mainstream scientific assumptions about the nature of reality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very difficult, you know, when you go to Michigan State University, University of Michigan, and places like that, you're not going to find physics courses on the paranormal.
No,
really.
Definitely not.
I know.
and if you talk about it, then people start looking down their noses and going, oh, yeah, sure, pal. And you may even get the debunkers after you as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's referred to in a lot of ways very condescendingly. We said that was mentioned a little while ago by our last guest. A lot of these studies of the paranormal itself is referred to very condescendingly. Just like you said, Michael, there is an idea. You don't want to deal with that.
Yeah, so I think that's, say, one reason why, you know, I get a lot of invitations to speak at a lot of, I do have an audience in the archaeological world. I've presented a lot of papers at archaeology conferences and university archaeology classes and at, you know, scientific institutions around the world. But another part of my audience is what we might call the alternative science.
Yeah.
Organizations, the ones who are interested in the paranormal, interested in UFOs and things like that. And I find they tend to invite me, even though, you know, I'm talking about archaeology and they may be more interested in alien abductions and things like that. The common feature is this knowledge filter that they're very familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And that they see in their field there's a body of evidence that should be taken seriously but isn't because it contradicts, you know, the current theories and assumptions about the nature of reality. And when they see, you know, something that also demonstrates that, then they feel it's, you know, worthwhile to have somebody come and talk to them about, because it sort of helps make the point that there is a knowledge filtering process that goes on in the world of science.
And that goes on a lot, too. You know, I want to talk about this other thing, too, you mentioned also concerning, you know, the whole archaeological community. God, I am so off my game today, I swear. You said that archaeology, what was that saying again? Archaeology is
not a science, it's a vendetta.
It's a vendetta. We find that in the paranormal community, too, that there are people that are there's people that have, I mean, everybody has their own idea. I mean, there are a lot of different theories out there, there's a lot of different theories to archaeology, even though it is a little more harder on the science end, right?
Sure.
Where you do have somebody who has their idea, and they're the one that they write a book or whatever, and they say, this is what happened, I am right, go away. This is what happened. I figured it out. There's no, and, but then you might have somebody that steps in. Doug,
I've seen this over and over.
Yeah,
yeah.
you will have somebody that steps up and says, "Hey, look, you know, I kind of have some, you know, some hard scientific evidence that kind of points it in this direction a little bit." And that's where you were saying, like you mentioned, Michael, that there is this subject for debate where people will go back and forth. And if it is something that kind of leans on more of an alternative end, where it may be a little bit more of a different idea, people start to shut it down. I want to cite a specific case, actually, if you don't mind, later on.
Sure.
Concerning
yeah.
that, because it's actually concerning a person we had on the show before, which it may not be as far as years ago, it isn't quite as old as things we're talking about right now, but it's the same application. There is a lot of that I see, especially in archaeology, especially, you know, with a lot of people out there who are out there doing this work, that they are very cutthroat. I've seen that with a lot of people.
Well, that does happen. And it's still, I mean, the two cases I mentioned, in the first part of our talk here, were from the 19th century. But it's something that goes on even today, right up to the present. There's one case, that illustrates that. And that's the case of Virginia Steen McIntyre. Now, she's an American geologist that I know. And, back in the 1970s, when she was a young woman just beginning her whole career in geology, kind of a newly minted PhD, she was involved in dating an archaeological site in Mexico at a place called Huayalaco. It's near the town of Puebla in central Mexico. And there was a group of American archaeologists there who had done some excavations, and they'd come up with some stone tools and, arrowheads and things like that. We're not talking about things that would have been made by some kind of ape man, but, there were things that would have been made by human beings like us. And, of course, they wanted to know how old these things were, so the archaeologists brought in a team of geologists to date the site. So Virginia Steen McIntyre and her colleagues used four different scientific methods to date the site, the uranium series method, the zircon fission track method. I won't go into the details, but they used the latest professional methods to date the site. And they said, considering all the four different methods, we think this site is at least 250,000 years old. The archaeologists couldn't believe it. They said, that's impossible. Human beings capable of making artifacts like this didn't exist anywhere in the world, 250,000 years ago. What to speak of North America? Because their current idea is that the first humans came into North America
over the Bering,
over the Bering Land Straits, maybe 15,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago max. So to have this kind of evidence in Mexico at 250,000 years was just impossible. So they refused to publish the age for the site given to them by their own handpicked team of geologists. So when Virginia, and instead they published a far younger age for the site. So when Virginia Steen McIntyre independently published, the true age of the site, she found that all of her opportunities for professional advancement were suddenly blocked off. Colleagues were speaking behind her back. She's a maverick, a publicity seeker, a this, a that, the other. And her career was just ruined because of that. She just went off to live with her husband, in a little town, in the Rocky Mountains near Boulder, Colorado. And she just remained silent for 10 years until I found out about her work and wrote about it in Forbidden Archaeology. And partly because of that, partly because of what I did, there are now some new investigations going on down there that I think are eventually going to vindicate her, which I would really like to see.
That'd be very cool to see.
But it is one of these things. It's just like you're mentioning. I mean, her, because she just stood up for the science that she did. Her career, practically speaking, was ruined. She lost a teaching position, that she, held at a university. I mean, it was just amazing to see what happened to her.
It's funny that this came up, because the last guest we had on talked about the same type of thing, that a lot of people that are in these higher levels, that are professors, that are within these circles, they experience these problems. If they try to take on the norm, or what is the accepted answer to how we were created, or whatever you want to say, they can face career problems. And that's what Stephen Browdy, talked about, our last guest.
He's a paranormal researcher. I've read some of his work.
Oh, okay, very cool. We have colleagues here. Yeah. This is awesome. Well, I take a quick break here. We're going to talk more about this. I want to talk about a case that we discussed here on the show. Like almost a year ago.
Well, I'd love to hear about it.
Yeah, it's something I'm sure. I think when we talk about it, you're going to know who I'm talking about and the case itself.
I think you'll know immediately who we're talking about.
But I think it's dying to be talked about as far as this conversation goes.
It is.
Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back.